Chapter 64. Evening exhibitions, rare up to that period and given only exceptionally, became common in Nero's time, both in the circus and amphitheater. The Augustans liked them, frequently because they were followed by feasts and drinking bouts which lasted till daylight. Though the people were sated already with blood spilling, still, when the news went forth that the end of the games was approaching, and that the last of the Christians were to die at an evening spectacle, a countless audience assembled in the amphitheater. The Augustans came to a man, for they understood that it would not be a common spectacle. They knew that Caesar had determined to make for himself a tragedy out of the suffering of Vinicius. Tigellinus had kept secret the kind of punishment intended for the betrothed of the young tribune, but that merely roused general curiosity. Those who had seen Lygia at the house of Plautius told wonders of her beauty. Others were occupied above all with the question, would they see her really on the arena that day? For many of those who had heard the answer given Petronius and Nerva by Caesar, explained it in two ways. Some supposed simply that Nero would give, or perhaps had given the maiden to Vinicius. They remembered that she was a hostage, hence free to worship whatever divinities she liked, and that the law of nations did not permit her punishment. Uncertainty, waiting, and curiosity had mastered all spectators. Caesar arrived earlier than usual, and immediately at his coming people whispered that something uncommon would happen, for besides Tigellinus and Vatinius, Caesar had with him Cassius, a centurion of enormous size and gigantic strength, whom he summoned only when he wished to have a defender at his side, for example, when he desired night expeditions to the Subura, where he arranged the amusement called a geisho, which consisted in tossing on a soldier's mantle maidens met on the way. It was noted also that certain precautions had been taken in the amphitheater itself. The Praetorian guards were increased. Command over them was held, not by a centurion, but by the tribune Subrius Flavius, known hitherto for blind attachment to Nero. It was understood, then, that Caesar wished in every case to guard himself against an outburst of despair from Vinicius, and curiosity rose all the more. Every eye was turned with strained gaze to the place where the unfortunate lover was sitting. He was exceedingly pale, and his forehead was covered with drops of sweat. He was in as much doubt as were other spectators, but alarmed to the lowest depth of his soul. Petronius knew not what would happen. He was silent, except that, while turning from Nerva, he asked Vinicius whether he was ready for everything, and next, whether he would remain at the spectacle. To both questions Vinicius answered yes, but a shudder passed through his whole body. He divined that Petronius did not ask without reason. For some time he had lived with only half his life. He had sunk in death, and reconciled himself to Lygia's death, since for both it was to be liberation and marriage. But he learned now that it was one thing to think of the last moment when it was distant, as of a quiet dropping asleep, and another to look at the torment of a person dearer to one than life. All sufferings endured formerly rose in him anew. Despair, which had been set at rest, began again to cry in his soul. The former desire to save Lygia at any price seized him anew. Beginning with the morning, he had tried to go to the canicula to be sure that she was there, but the Praetorians watched every entrance, and orders were so strict that the soldiers, even those whom he knew, would not be softened by prayers or gold. It seemed to the tribune that uncertainty would kill him before he should see the spectacle. Somewhere at the bottom of his heart the hope was still throbbing, that perhaps Lygia was not in the amphitheater, that his fears were groundless. At times he seized on this hope with all his strength. He said in his soul that Christ might take her to himself out of the prison, but could not permit her torture in the circus. Formerly he was resigned to the divine will in everything. Now, when repulsed from the doors of the canicula, he returned to his place in the amphitheater, and when he learned, from the curious glances turned on him, that the most dreadful suppositions might be true, he began to implore in his soul with passionateness almost approaching a threat. he thou can't erupt kick tea, clenching his fists convulsively, thou canst. Hitherto he had not supposed that that moment when present would be so terrible. Now, without clear consciousness of what was happening in his mind, he had the feeling that if he should see Lydia tortured, his love for God would be turned to hatred, and his faith to despair. But he was amazed at the feeling, for he feared to offend Christ, whom he was imploring for mercy and miracles. He implored no longer for her life. He wished merely that she should die, before they brought her to the arena, and from the abyss of his pain he repeated in spurt, "Do not refuse even this, and I will love thee still more than hitherto." And then his thoughts raged as a sea torn by a whirlwind. A desire for blood and vengeance was roused in him. He was seized by a mad wish to rush at Nero, and stifle him there in presence of all the spectators. But he felt that desire to be a new offense against Christ, and a breach of his command. To his head flew at times flashes of hope, that everything before which his soul was trembling would be turned aside by an almighty and merciful hand. But they were quenched at once, as if in measureless sorrow, that he who could destroy that circus with one word, and save Lydia had abandoned her, though she trusted in him and loved him with all the strength of her pure heart. And he thought, moreover, that she was lying there in that dark place, weak, defenseless, deserted, abandoned to the whim or disfavor of brutal guards, drawing her last breath, perhaps, while he had to wait, helpless, in that dreadful amphitheater, without knowing what torture was prepared for her, or what he would witness in a moment. Finally, as a man falling over a precipice grasps at everything which grows on the edge of it, so did he grasp with both hands at the thought that faith of itself could save her. That one method remained. Peter had said that faith could move the earth to its foundations. Hence he rallied. He crushed out in himself, he compressed his whole being into the sentence, "I believe," and he looked for a miracle. But as an overdrawn cord may break, so exertion broke him. The pallor of death covered his face, and his body relaxed. He thought then that his prayer had been heard, for he was dying. It seemed to him that Lydia must surely die too, and that Christ would take them to himself in that way. The arena, the white togas, the countless spectators, the light of thousands of lamps and torches, all vanished from his vision. But his weakness did not last long. After a while he roused himself, or rather the stamping of the impatient multitude roused him. "Thou art ill," said Petronius. "Give command to bear thee home." And without regard to what Caesar would say, he rose to support Vinicius, and go out with him. His heart was filled with pity, and, moreover, he was irritated beyond endurance, because Caesar was looking through the emerald at Vinicius, studying his pain with satisfaction, to describe it afterwards, perhaps, in pathetic strophes, and win the applause of hearers. Vinicius shook his head. He might die in that amphitheater, but he could not go out of it. Moreover, the spectacle might begin any moment. In fact, at that very instant almost, the prefect of the city waved a red handkerchief. The hinges opposite Caesar's podium creaked, and out of the dark gully came Ursus into the brightly lighted arena. The giant blinked, dazed evidently by the glitter of the arena. Then he pushed into the center, gazing around as if to see what he had to meet. It was known to all the Augustans, and to most of the spectators, that he was the man who had stifled Croton. Hence at sight of him a murmur passed along every bench. In Rome there was no lack of gladiators larger by far than the common measure of man, but Roman eyes had never seen the like of Ursus. Cassius, standing in Caesar's podium, seemed puny compared with that legion. Senators, Vestals, Caesar, the Augustans, and the people gazed with the delight of experts at his mighty limbs as large as tree trunks, at his breast as large as two shields joined together, and his arms of a Hercules. The murmur rose every instant. For those multitudes there could be no higher pleasure than to look at those muscles in play in the exertion of a struggle. The murmur rose to shouts, and eager questions were put: "Where do the people live who can produce such a giant?" He stood there, in the middle of the amphitheater, naked, more like a stone colossus than a man, with a collected expression, and at the same time the sad look of a barbarian. And while surveying the empty arena, he gazed wonderingly with his blue childlike eyes, now at the spectators, now at Caesar, now at the grating of the canicula, whence, as he thought, his executioners would come. At the moment when he stepped into the arena, his simple heart was beating for the last time with the hope that perhaps a cross was waiting for him. But when he saw neither the cross, nor the hole in which it might be put, he thought that he was unworthy of such favor, that he would find death in another way, and surely from wild beasts. He was unarmed, and had determined to die as became a confessor of the Yam, peacefully and patiently. Meanwhile he wished to pray once more to the Savior, so he knelt on the arena, joined his hands, and raised his eyes toward the stars which were glittering in the lofty opening of the amphitheater. That act displeased the crowds. They had had enough of those Christians who died like sheep. They understood that, if the giant would not defend himself, the spectacle would be a failure. Here and there hisses were heard. Some began to cry for Scorgers, whose office it was to lash combatants unwilling to fight. But soon all had grown silent, for no one knew what was waiting for the giant, nor whether he would eat, be or Katie to struggle when he met death eye to eye. In fact, they had not long to wait. Suddenly the shrill sound of brazen trumpets was heard, and at that signal a grating opposite Caesar's podium was opened, and into the arena rushed, amid shouts of peacekeepers, an enormous German oriches, bearing on his head the naked body of a woman. Lygia! Lygia! He cried, Vinicius. Then he seized his hair near the temples, squirmed like a man who feels a sharp dart in his body, and began to repeat in hoarse accents, I believe! I believe! O Christ, a miracle! And he did not even feel that Petronius covered his head, that moment, with the toga. It seemed to him that death or pain had closed his eyes. He did not look, he did not see. The feeling of some awful emptiness possessed him. In his head there remained not a thought, his lips merely repeated, as if in madness, I believe! I believe! I believe! This time the amphitheater was silent. The Augustans rose in their places, as one man, for in the arena something uncommon had happened. That legion, obedient and ready to die, when he saw his queen on the horns of the wild beast, sprang up, as if touched by living fire, and bending forward he ran at the raging animal. From all breasts a sudden cry of amazement was heard, after which came deep silence. The legion fell on the raging bull in a twinkle, and seized him by the horns. Look! Cried Petronius, snatching the toga from the head of Vinicius. The latter rose and bent back his head. His face was as pale as linen, and he looked into the arena with a glassy, vacant stare. All breasts ceased to breathe. In the amphitheater a fly might be heard on the wing. People could not believe their own eyes. Since Rome was Rome, no one had seen such a spectacle. The legion held the wild beast by the horns. The man's feet sank in the sand to his ankles, his back was bent like a drawn bow, his head was hidden between his shoulders, on his arms the muscles came out, so that the skin almost burst from their pressure, but he had stopped the bull in his tracks. And the man and the beast remained so still, that the spectators thought themselves looking at a picture showing a deed of Hercules or Theseus, or a group hewn from stone. But in that apparent repose there was a tremendous exertion of two struggling forces. The bull sank his feet as well as did the man in the sand, and his dark, shaggy body was curved, so that it seemed a gigantic ball. Which of the two would fail first, which would fall first, that was the question for those spectators enamored of such struggles, a question which at that moment meant more for them than their own fate, than all Rome and its lordship over the world. That legion was in their eyes then a demigod worthy of honor and statues. Caesar himself stood up as well as others. He and Tigellinus, hearing of the man's strength, had arranged this spectacle purposely, and said to each other with a jeer, Let that slayer of Croton kill the bull which we choose for him, So they looked now with amazement at that picture, as if not believing that it could be real. In the amphitheater were men who had raised their arms and remained in that posture. Sweat covered the faces of others, as if they themselves were struggling with the beast. In the circus nothing was heard save the sound of flame in the lamps, and the crackle of bits of coal as they dropped from the torches. Their voices died on the lips of the spectators, but their hearts were beating in their breasts, as if to split them. It seemed to all that the struggle was lasting for ages. But the man and the beast continued on in their monstrous exertion. One might have said that they were planted in the earth. Meanwhile, a dull roar resembling a groan was heard from the arena, after which a brief shout was wrested from every breast, and again there was silence. People thought themselves dreaming till the enormous head of the bull began to turn in the iron hands of the barbarian. The face, neck, and arms of the legend grew purple. His back bent still more. It was clear that he was rallying the remnant of his superhuman strength, but that he could not last long. Duller and duller, hoarser and hoarser, more and more painful grew the groan of the bull as it mingled with the whistling breath from the breast of the giant. The head of the beast turned more and more, and from his jaws crept forth a long, foaming tongue. A moment more, and to the ears of spectators sitting near came as it were the crack of breaking bones. Then the beast rolled on the earth with his neck twisted in death. The giant removed in a twinkle the ropes from the horns of the bull, and, raising the maiden, began to breathe hurriedly. His face became pale, his hair stuck together from sweat, his shoulders and arms seemed flooded with water. For a moment he stood, as if only half conscious. Then he raised his eyes and looked at the spectators. The amphitheater had gone wild. The walls of the building were trembling from the roar of tens of thousands of people. Since the beginning of spectacles, there was no memory of such excitement. Those who were sitting on the highest rows came down, crowding in the passages between benches, to look more nearly at the strong man. Everywhere were heard cries for mercy, passionate and persistent, which soon turned into one unbroken thunder. That giant had become dear to those people enamored of physical strength. He was the first personage in Rome. He understood that the multitude were striving to grant him his life and restore him his freedom, but clearly his thought was not on himself alone. He looked around a while, then approached Caesar's podium, and, holding the body of the maiden on his outstretched arms, raised his eyes with entreaty, as if to say, "Have mercy on her. Save the maiden. I did that for her sake." The spectators understood perfectly what he wanted. At sight of the unconscious maiden, who near the enormous legend seemed a child, emotion seized the multitude of knights and senators. Her slender form, as white as if chiseled from alabaster, her fainting, the dreadful danger from which the giant had freed her, and finally her beauty and attachment had moved every heart. Some thought the man a father begging mercy for his child. Pity burst forth suddenly, like a flame. They had had blood, death, and torture in sufficiency. Voices choked with tears began to entreat mercy for both. Meanwhile, Ursus, holding the girl in his arms, moved around the arena, and with his eyes, and with motions, begged her life for her. Now Vinicius started up from his seat, sprang over the barrier which separated the front places from the arena, and, running to Lygia, covered her naked body with his toga. Then he tore apart the tunic on his breast, laid bare the scars left by wounds received in the Armenian War, and stretched out his hands to the audience. At this, the enthusiasm of the multitude passed everything seen in the circus before. The crowd stamped and howled. Voices calling for mercy grew simply terrible. People not only took the part of the athlete, but rose in defense of the soldier, the maiden, their love. Thousands of spectators turned to Caesar with flashes of anger in their eyes, and with clenched fists. But Caesar halted and hesitated. Against Vinicius he had no hatred indeed, and the death of Lygia did not concern him, but he preferred to see the body of the maiden rent by the horns of the bull, or torn by the claws of beasts. His cruelty, his deformed imagination, and deformed desires found a kind of delight in such spectacles. And now Tile people wanted to rob him. Hence anger appeared on his bloated face. Self-love also would not let him yield to the wish of the multitude, and still he did not dare to oppose it, through his inborn cowardice. So he gazed around to see, if among the Augustians at least, he could not find fingers turned down in sign of death. But Petronius held up his hand, and looked into Nero's face almost challengingly. Vestinius, superstitious but inclined to enthusiasm, a man who feared ghosts, but not the living, gave a sign for mercy also. So did Sevenus, the senator, so did Nerva, so did Tullius Senecia, so did the famous leader Astorius Scapula, and Antistius, and Piso, and Vetus, and Crispinus, and Minucius Thermus, and Pontius Telesinus, and the most important of all, one honored by the people, Thrasea. In view of this, Caesar took the emerald from his eye with an expression of contempt and offense, went to Gelinus, whose desire was to spite Petronius, turned to him and said, "Yield not, divinity, we have the Praetorians." Then Nero turned to the place, where command over the Praetorians was held by the stern Subrius Flavius, hitherto devoted with whole soul to him, and saw something unusual. The face of the old tribune was stern, but covered with tears, and he was holding his hand up in sign of mercy. Now rage began to possess the multitude. Dust rose from beneath the stamping feet, and filled the amphitheater. In the midst of shouts were heard cries, "Colon Ahenobarbus, matricide, incendiary." Nero was alarmed. Romans were absolute lords in the circus. Former Caesars, and especially Caligula, had permitted themselves sometimes to act against the will of the people. This, however, called forth disturbance always, going sometimes to bloodshed. But Nero was in a different position. First, as a comedian and a singer, he needed the people's favor. Second, he wanted it on his side against the Senate and the patricians, and especially after the burning of Rome he strove by all means to win it, and turn their anger against the Christians. He understood, besides, that to oppose longer was simply dangerous. A disturbance begun in the circus might seize the whole city, and have results incalculable. He looked once more at Subrius Flavius, at Sevenus the centurion, a relative of the senator, at the soldiers, and seeing everywhere frowning brows, excited faces, and eyes fixed on him, he gave the sign for mercy. Then a thunder of applause was heard from the highest seats to the lowest. The people were sure of the lives of the condemned, for from that moment they went under their protection, and even Caesar would not have dared to pursue them any longer with his vengeance. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.